Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this, the last show of our current series, we get into the foreground of art and arts education by way of the 2014 graduate shows at the University of Portsmouth. We capture the acoustic brilliance of singer-songwriter Liz Green as she stops off at Southsea's Pie and Vinyl, and we dust off the canvas and don our knee highs for the forthcoming festival's season. Joining me as ever is the sartorial warlock of culture who's never out of the crease and ever ready at the bat, it's Dave Allen.
Hiya.
And the calm at the eye of a paint storm, the luminescent Simon Mobbs.
Hello.
And we're going to start tonight with art and arts education. Okay, so I'm already getting a bit lost in this, but we're going to start with focusing on a recent show 2014, which is a graduate show at the University of Portsmouth. Simon, we're going to let you kick off with this to explain kind of what it is and why it is.
Okay, so on a yearly basis, you have a show to showcase the work of the graduates from the current year. What's particularly special this year is you've got a new building to show off as well, and your nice new modernist building, lots of light, lots of mezzanine layers. It looks very nice.
This is the Eldon Building.
It is indeed.
Which, a kind of extension to it.
Yeah.
If you don't know where that is, if you're listening in Portsmouth, that's at the end of Winston Churchill Avenue, and it's opposite the fantastic Courts Building, which is another icon, I think.
And yeah, it's very much designed with the public coming in as in mind. Like the entrance area is very much now an open space, like a gallery type setting. So at the show this year, as with previous years, you've got graphic design, photography, fashion and textiles, film and media studies, music and sound technology, computer animation, computer games, architecture, urban design, interior design, photography, fine art, a whole range of creative subjects on showcase here.
But no potato shapes, I noticed. No potato cutting shapes.
No pasta and glue and paint.
Although at least if there were, I miss them. But one of the first things you're hit by, if you like, when you go into the building is the photography and the photography
indeed.
Section. And I was really struck by the quality of what was there. You know, I was kind of thinking, well, it might be a bit amateur. But again, that's me looking at it through a different lens. But the quality of the stuff that was there, I was really hit by. I didn't quite get some of the things that were kind of hanging on the wall. But it was very, you know, these people take this very seriously.
It's a very nice space, isn't it? It looks like a really plush art gallery. And like you say, they've invested in high quality prints. In particular, there was one that stood out to me. Danius Skiuka did a series on Taste for Street, where he walked around various city streets taking photographs of people that he felt were well-dressed or had a kind of unique style. Very much influenced by a website called The Sartorialist. He does a very similar thing around sort of glamorous cities. Just people he bumps into on the street get a photograph. Anyway, there was a particular photograph, two twins walking. Did you say it was down Albert Road you recognised?
Well, I looked at the... I've got a picture of it in front of me here. I looked at this image, and I think what we're describing here is Craneswater School on Albert Road and Pompey on a Roll, which is, I believe, a popular sandwich manufacturing firm. That's where it's taken.
And not... And what's particularly the key focus is the two dressed young women, twins, walking a pet rabbit each on a lead, which isn't something you see every day.
Well, I think, you know, we've all been there, I think, haven't we, on Albert Road, or at least in our minds, we might have been there. One thing that occurred to me about this picture is when I looked at it, I studied it closely. It's a bit more about how the other people in the background are reacting to the photographer rather than what he's photographing. But also, I wondered whether they're actually twins. When you look at the image, right, my eldest brothers are twins, okay? So I know there are differences between twins.
Okay, I can definitely confirm, because I taught them.
Okay.
I taught them about 2 years ago, they're definitely twins.
So they're what I think medical people, what doctors might call very identical twins. So I looked at it and I thought, is it actually two people? I didn't get the rabbits. What was the rabbit's inference? Were we supposed to kind of, was it an Alice in Wonderland thing or what?
I don't know. I guess he spotted them on the street, thought it looked interesting and got the photograph. I mean, I've got people that used to live near me that used to walk ferrets, you know. You do see somebody else walking a raccoon. I've seen a raccoon being walked around Porchester Castle before.
This could be a whole new genre of radio program, couldn't it? I wondered though whether it, you know, looking at it, and I noticed the kind of the quality of it. It's difficult these days to tell, I think, when there's a real photo and a photo that's been tampered with or been played with in some way. And we've touched on this before in previous programmes.
I think that's right, but I think the question goes further than that. has it been tampered with? But even if it hasn't been tampered with, has he just come across those people by chance? Is he really just going out and looking like a documentary maker? Or does he know these quirky pair of people? Does he know that they've got rabbits? Does he has he said to them the night before, hey, you know, and everybody nowadays calls all this stuff surreal, which is a terrible misuse of the term. And I think they should be banged up in prison for misusing it. But, you know, it would be really surreal if you took them out on a lead, wouldn't it? You know, but it may simply be absolutely the truth that he's walking along Albert Road with his camera and the twins walk towards him looking quite stylish with rabbits.
He's never snapped you walking your blackbirds around the grammar school.
He's never snapped me as far as I know. Perhaps he doesn't tell. It looks to me from the photographs I can see that he's taken as if he does tell people. That's another question, of course. I mean, you know, with long lenses nowadays, you know, he could be 100 yards away. I don't think he is with those, as far as I can see. And Simon's right about the quality of them. They're very... I think that's a really important part of modern art education, actually, that what they're doing here is trying to find a relationship between students who have an original idea, you know, an interesting eye, but at the same time are developing a serious set of skills which are transferable... Because it may be that in a year's time he's working for a travel company and he's, you know, he's snapping shots of people having happy holidays in, you know, Benidorm or something, you know, because that's how he's earning his living. So he's got to have those skills. He's got to be able to shoot properly and know which lens to use and so on and so on. And, you know, and why printing it on particular paper is important and so on and so on. I think there was a lot of that in the shows on the whole, of people developing really quite serious employability skills.
And that cuts to the nub of this, doesn't it? That, you know, this isn't just an exhibition, a show. This is the culmination of learning and the acquisition of skills, and then being able to demonstrate that in a very, as you said, you know, in a very professional, formal, almost formal kind of gallery environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me personally, there's an added element where I teach for students about 3 or 4 years before this stage at a sixth form level, and then I come back sort of 3 or 4 years later and see how they've moved on and see how much more professional they've become. And I think as well with creativity, it's one of those, the arts as an area can get attacked quite a bit because, well, what are you going to do with that degree? How are you going to actually kind of make a living out of that? But there's a lot of transferable skills that can come. You might not actually go and end up becoming a great fine artist painter that takes the art world by storm, or becoming, you know, the most famous graphic designer there is. But there's a whole range of things: lateral thinking, resourcefulness, project management, communication, a very particular set of skills that you maybe can't quite get from other sorts of degrees.
Well, it's interesting because there were a couple, certainly on the ground floor in the photography section, there was one, I think, which was around ritual, and in particular focusing on Romania and some of the kind of traditional things that they very much try and keep alive in terms of dress and dance and those kind of things. And also a strange sequence which was trying to recreate Peter Rabbit, I think, or the Peter Rabbit story, with women hiding in trees. Well, at least that's my reading of it. And I looked at those compositions and I looked at those pieces and I thought, these could very easily be stuck in a glossy magazine somewhere, you know, in a copy of GQ or Tatler advertising aftershaves or, you know, some kind of luxury electronic product. So if I get that message instantly, you know, they're kind of at that level, aren't they? I don't want to damn them to doing that forever, but, you know, they're kind of at that level already.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a couple of things here. I think in the digital age and with the technology becoming that bit more affordable, it is possibly easier to get your hands on the equipment than it was maybe 20 years ago. If you want to get set up in graphic design, if you want to get set up in photography, animation, any of these areas, I mean, with a relatively sort of, you know, small budget, you can kind of get yourself up to not far off what the high-end professionals are using as well. And then after that, okay, you've got the kit, but what else do you need? And that's where the art school comes in, that's where the design school comes in, because it's not just about using the kit. There's aesthetic judgments and various other kind of things that you need to have put in there as well.
I think the other great thing for me as a pleb, as I described myself earlier, is I got to explore and lurk, if I can use that word, an art department. I haven't been in an art department since my sixth form, basically, and I went into all these strange white spaces with all kinds of weird things in, and there was that classic thing where there was a lady on a computer in a room at the back, and she kind of leant back on her chair to have a look at me to see if I was a subversive or I was doing something I shouldn't be. And it was great. It was a great feeling about that space. And for me, it's not a space I go into. it was very clear that it was a working environment. You know, it wasn't a clinical working environment. There was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of ideas and a lot of stuff going on, you know, a lot of interactivity.
They're a lot cleaner than they used to be. I mean, you know, if I can speak as a, you know, as an old time art teacher and student, one of the things I loved about them, and I'm talking about the first time I ever went to what is now called the Eldon Building as a student, and it was a part time student on a Saturday morning. I was still at school, and it was I think 1966. And what struck me there was that there was paint splattered everywhere, that it smelt of linseed oil, that there were people working in clay and plaster. Everybody walked around with jeans that were caked in whatever the material they'd been working in, because they'd just wiped their hands down it. And that's all I wanted to be, really, was just kind of dirty and messy like them. And then there was a phase when, not that long after that, when the graphic designers had pristine metal rulers and letraset and rotoring pens, and it was still pretty clean, but it is very different. It's not dirty, it's not messy, it's not untidy. And sometimes it seems to me that that's analogous with this drive to being economically productive and focused on career moves. But I have to be careful about that and not start painting some picture of a halcyon past, because I think it's very important to emphasise that in the visual arts in particular, and this is a much broader building now because it's got music and performing arts and film and so on. In the visual arts, if you trace the history of the visual arts back to the 19th century, the development of the visual arts in the 19th century in this country was tied really very powerfully to the Industrial Revolution, and to the idea that what we needed were designers and people with hand-eye coordination who could actually boost the economic output and products of the British Empire. It wasn't about training expressive individuals at all, but it's just that, you know, as somebody, you know, as a student and initially an art teacher of the 60s and 70s, I guess those were the halcyon days of getting your hands dirty and of being an expressive individual. And to some degree, I think they're gone now. And I mean, one explanation for that may simply be that art colleges were independent institutions until the early 70s, and then they were taken into the polytechnics, and then the courses became degree level, which they weren't before. Some of the work is fascinating. I mean, I have a great pal who is about to retire, actually, but has been running music and sound technology for some years now, since it was first introduced, and I went to his bit of the exhibition on Friday, and they were showing it just looked me when I walked in as if they were watching telly, because there were little cartoons, and then there was a piece from a documentary, and there was that famous science presenter who used to be a rock and roll star whose name I've completely forgotten, but you'll probably tell me who it is in a minute. It was always on the BBC. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He's the groovy looking young guy with
dark, I think, hair. You mean Brian Cox.
That's who I mean. That's what you mean. Was he a rock and roll musician?
He was in a band called D-Ream.
There we are then. Okay, I've got all that right. And he was up there when I first walked in, and I said, oh, what are you doing? Just watching telly. And there was Brian Cox up there talking with background music, and my pal Dennis said, well, just have a look. And I watched it. I said, yeah, okay, so what are we doing here? Are we watching the telly? And what they'd done, they'd given the students this piece from a Brian Cox BBC documentary, and the students had wiped the whole soundtrack, and they had re-overdubbed his speech with lip sync, and they had composed their own soundtrack music to go underneath it. And then the next piece was a kind of wacky little kids cartoon, and again it was lots of sounds of, you know, ping boing, boom, boom, and they'd done the whole thing to fit the, you know, so synchronized with the actions, and you know, and so what they, you know, what they're doing there is essentially industry-based stuff. You know, they're learning how to produce the audio bit of what we take for granted on television, you know.
Now, always when I go, as you know, whenever I go to anything artistic or artistically focused, if I'm not confused and baffled, then it hasn't been a good exhibition or a good show for me. There were a couple of things that I saw whilst I was wandering around the third floor of the Eldon Building. I've never been up there before. There was a piece which was essentially a lamp created out of cutlery.
Yeah, I saw that.
And a bulb.
That's the MA in fine art.
That confused me immensely. I didn't quite know what to make of it. I wondered if I'd strayed into a bit of the building I shouldn't have. In the same way that also there's a room with a projector and a photocopier churning out bits of paper, and then the projector's projecting something on a kind of light box. I thought, have I knocked something over, or is this someone's office? But also, I think, let's just say that the pinnacle of my confusion came from this piece entitled Kittler and Muttler. where Hitler has been rendered as a cat and a dog. Now, there's some searing satire behind that, I'm sure, but I'm not quite sure about it.
No, I missed that. I know about the first two pieces you talked about. I mean, I think the first piece, actually, with, you know, is a bunch of found objects, you know, kitchen utensils and a sort of lampshade thing. And it's actually aesthetically quite conventionally beautiful in its own way. You know, I mean, it has a kind of long neck and a round top to it. And it could almost be a piece of, you know, a piece of Renaissance sculpture if you didn't know what the objects were, you know, ornamentation on a building of some kind. So one of the things about that kind of fine art nowadays is it's always accompanied by some kind of statement. There's a sense for me, well, that one has to understand that they have to do that because they are going to be assessed on this work. People are going to come around and look at this and give it a mark, which is different, as Simon said earlier, from an ordinary exhibition. Sometimes it seems to me that there ought to be a requirement that somehow the work stands on its own, and maybe the statement ought to be hidden, and you only go for the statement if you really haven't got a clue what you're looking at. I'm not sure about that. Maybe that's an old-fashioned modernist aesthetic, really. But I mean, it's interesting because that room was next to illustration, and I always have a lot of time for illustration. I think some of the work in illustration is always quite delightful.
Well, I had a good look around there, and I was one of the things that kind of I forgot the name of the artist or the illustrator, but there was one thing that I was kind of mesmerised by, and I thought, what does this remind me of? And it reminded me of a Robert Crumb cartoon. There was a panel of cartoons of kind of graphic novel style.
Okay.
A little bit cheeky.
Right.
And I'm not going to mention some of the names of some of the things. A little bit, let's say, sexually explicit. Yeah. Certainly not for evening radio. But really interestingly done. And I kind of thought, what are they trying to get to here? This is beyond Viz. This isn't just kind of crude, popular cartoons. No. There's a lot more to this.
Yeah.
So there were nuggets of things like that hiding around. I also, one of the things I picked up, I didn't pick up every business card I saw. I thought, I'm going to be discerning, because I know you two will pick on me if I'm not. There was some work by a guy called Greg Bennison, who, you can see his business card now, I'm just holding it up, just to describe it very briefly. It looks like flaking paint. Looks like flaking grey paint on a red background.
Yeah.
But there was a whole presentation, a whole wall of his stuff, and it really kind of struck me. I really liked it. I don't know why I liked it, but it was really sort of, you know, it had that kind of manufactured but natural feel about it. So it was well worth kind of delving into the nether regions, if you like, of the building.
I think one of the things that's slightly disappeared from some earlier times is the capacity and willingness to put people together and get them to work together, you know. I mean, to put, you know, and I think sometimes it shouldn't be too obvious either. I think you might put illustrators with musicians and say, okay, I don't know what you guys could do together. Let's see. Let's find out. You might not do that in the final year either. I think sometimes, you know, it's there was at one time a big experimental music thing that fine art students themselves were doing at the university, and that was fascinating because most of them couldn't play music at all, but they were forced to draw upon things they understood about making and creativity and so on, and come to, you know, some understandings of all of that. I think that as a process can sometimes be really valuable, and you're always up against it as a tutor because there's always another exam to get the students through, there's always another show to put on, and we really haven't got time to devote 6 weeks to doing this that might just end up as a mess, you know. But actually it's a shame. I think it's always been one of the great qualities of the old independent art colleges that you could just end up with something that's a mess but actually take a great deal from it.
If you're interested in finding more about the Faculty of Creative and Cultural Industries at the University of Portsmouth, you can log on to their website, which is www.port.ac.uk/CCI. There's also a 24-hour live broadcast available at www.cciChannel.port.ac.uk. We move now to music, and I caught up recently with Liz Green when she played her set at South Seas Pie and Vinyl to talk about her new album, Haul Away. So I'm with Liz Green, the back of Pie and Vinyl, surrounded by vinyl, as ever. Liz, you just played a great set. Really enjoyed that. Start off by telling me about your new album, which is called Haul Away.
Yeah.
Do I have to say that with an exclamation? Is it Haul Away? Is it that kind of thing?
You can say it however you want.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the kind of the feel of that album? What's the focus of that?
Not really. It's just a bunch of songs I made it, put on an album, and then people always want you to have themes to talk about in these kind of situations. So after I'd made it, knowing this from last time round, where I didn't think of anything, I had to kind of do it on the hoof. I went through it and picked out some themes. But like, I was reading a book by the man who did The Golden Compass and that trilogy.
Philip Pullman.
Philip Pullman. And Philip Pullman has done this kind of thing about fairy tales, and he writes in it, he's just like, what are themes other than like kind of patterns that one person sees between one thing and another? So, you know, it's not, I don't think anybody ever writes something with the intention of these themes being there. I don't know, maybe they do, but I don't think so.
You made it sound very simple.
Yeah.
But you were very finely tuned, and there was real emotion in what you were doing. What? So it can't be that simple.
Well, no, singing songs is simple.
Is it? Just
open your mouth, sing some songs. That's how it sounds.
A bit more process to that, is there?
Well, kind of, not really.
Were there things that you kind of sort of came to through this album? You mentioned while you were playing that most of the songs were about death or funerals.
Oh, no, that's not really true for this album. I just said that because I was there.
Your album came out in April,
yeah.
So it's been out for a few weeks now. It's been very well received. We've got some really good reviews.
Yeah. It's got some really dreadful reviews as well, but that's life.
You get a balance. You don't. I think one of the things to remember is don't read the reviews, I think.
I know I don't, but people tell me about them.
I've just told you, I've broken the golden rule.
No.
One thing very generously on your website, you're giving people a free download of your version of the Sisters of Mercy, a Leonard Cohen song.
It was initially given away free, though, on a cover of Uncut, so we're not actually giving away anything that was ever
had
to pay for.
It's still there to be had.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a beautiful song, and quite a difficult song, actually, to cover, but you do it very well. Why did you choose that one?
Uncut said choose three Leonard Cohen songs, and actually I'd already done a cover of that for something else, so I chose that one.
Is that your favourite, or is it just one that you...
Oh no, also my mum likes Leonard Cohen, and that's one of her favourite songs, so yeah. Also, there wasn't very many left, because we had to choose it off the first album, I think it was, or one album, so... limited selection after that.
You got a good one, and you
chose one that had very simple chords as well. That helps.
It's always a trick, isn't it?
Yeah.
What sort of things were you listening to when you grew up? I mean, there's a real sort of folk and blues influence in some of the things that you're performing.
When I grew up as in childhood, grew up as in teenage years, grew up as in,
well, a bit of both, really. What was a very young Liz Green listening to?
I don't know. Probably ABBA.
ABBA. You know. Okay.
ABBA and Kylie Minogue mainly, I think, something like that. I don't know. I didn't really listen to any folk or blues music. I just still don't really listen to any folk music. I get called folk because I'm a woman who plays guitar, which is mainly non-amplified and mainly non-electric. And in that way, you know, sure, fine. But I don't know anything about folk, and actually people who are into folk sometimes come and tell me how not folk I am and how they've been misled. And one man was very angry when he turned up to a gig in Bristol and it wasn't folk music.
It's a very broad...
He told me about it, and I was like, all right, sorry about that. But you can't have your money back, that's fine.
It's a very broad bracket, I think, and you're right. People do get sort of wedged into it unfairly sometimes.
Well, I mean, I don't really mind, call me what you want, but I wouldn't say it was folk, mainly to just make sure that people who really like folk music wouldn't be misled by it. It's really not folk music it's folk music in the way that it's made by a human. That's what Big Bill Brunsie used to say, like, all music is folk music, it's made by people. I've never seen a horse sing a song.
You should maybe put that quote on your posters as just a caveat, just to warn off the kind of hardened folkies.
Yeah. It's just some tunes, that's what I said to my friend Biff after Thursday. It's just some songs. Put them on an album. It's not that simple. It takes a hell of a lot of hard work, but then you kind of do it and you're like, well, that's good. Let's make something better now.
Let's talk about the album artwork, and there's some particularly nice artwork, I think, of this album, Haul Away. Just to describe it for folks that haven't seen it, there's a picture of you on the cover. And you're kind of painted almost as if the sea level's rising above your nose.
Yes.
But there's a tear as well. There's a pointed tear on your cheek. Tell me a bit about
crying
the art.
A river into myself, like a Justin Timberlake song. That's essentially it. It's just an image.
And how did that come about? Did you do that painting, or did you have a friend that's a bit nifty with a
paintbrush? I didn't do the painting. I came up with the idea, and I painted it on myself with makeup, badly, like brown. so it was a very dirty sea. And I sent it to my friend who does photographs, and I said, can we do something like this? And she thought the idea was good, so she said yes.
With the album itself, there are a number of, as there always are, a number of formats available.
Yeah.
But it's a bit more personal this time, because you've got sort of lino prints and postcards and button badges that are red and made out of bear's eyes. Is that...
Well, I mean, they're made up. They're supposed to be made out of... I think the eyes are supposed to make bears out of, but I didn't. I just made badges out of them instead. I don't know where these things come from. I just get... I think maybe mainly boredom. Maybe if I had something better to do, then I wouldn't do that. I don't know. No, I like doing stuff like that. I did do stuff like that for the first album as well. In fact, there were like handmade editions of the first album.
I think that's what's really nice about that for me is that kind of lends to the experience of listening and to the, you know, to the experience of the album. It's not just buy a CD, stick it on. It's,
no.
You know, there's something very personal.
Well, that's kind of where I come from, though. That's the DIY ethos. It's not punk music, but I could have, back to that question, I grew up mainly listening to punk music. I like that DIY aesthetic, and it was kind of quite prevalent. It's, you know, and now with like internet and stuff, like mainly people are DIY, you know, you don't need any of the other trimmings to go with stuff. But me and all my friends started off like doing albums like that, kind of card covers and making them yourself and trying to do interesting things with it. And obviously you can't do that. My very first single I released, I hand drew every single cover, but obviously I can't do that anymore. That's just not sensible. It's not a sensible idea. So it was that idea of trying to give something that's from that without making life one endless
You don't want to be drawing. I did
take me ages to do the prints, though.
When you're listening to music, what kind of things are you listening to, and how are you listening?
How am I listening?
Are you kind of, you know, are you in a recliner with a LP and a mug of whiskey or something, or are you running around with an iPod?
I always listen to music when I travel round, but I've done that since, like, Walkmans are good, aren't they? I used to have one of them.
And they were fantastic.
So I walked round with that and a bag full of tapes, and I still do that, but obviously with MP3s, because it's lighter and you can put more stuff, other stuff in your bag. So yeah, mainly on trains and buses and planes and in the back of vans, on headphones, or in my room.
Now, originally, I think you're from Manchester, is that right? You're a Mancunian?
No, originally I'm from the Wirral.
Ah.
Some would say I'm a plastic Scouser.
I shouldn't make that mistake then. So,
it's all right, I don't really have an accent. I've lived in Manchester for 12 years, so it's a fair enough assumption to make.
And Manchester, controversially, I would argue, is the home of English music. Folks in Liverpool would throw things at me, but... Who should we be looking for that's coming out of Manchester at the moment, other than your good self?
I am not in the loop. I've never been in the loop, if there is a loop to be in. I don't know. I mean, I've no idea.
Okay.
No idea. Like, the only people I know, I don't know anybody. I don't have enough money to go out anymore, so I have no idea what's going on in Manchester. Maybe Songs for Walter. He's good. I know him. My friend's got a little record label called Red Deer Club, and Songs for Walter is on that, and actually Stealing Sheep used to be on Red Deer Club, so he does pretty well when it kicks off. So Songs for Walter is really good, and Pins, but they're doing well enough for themselves, I think, as it is, without plugging, but they're amazing and they're really good live. I don't know, I'm going to plug the Moulettes. They're not based in Manchester anymore, but they used to be based in Manchester, and their new album's coming out next week. And that's amazing. That's like that's pretty much all I've been listening to for the past 3 months.
That's a whole host of people that I didn't have on my radar that I can pick up and have a look at. So that's good.
That's a good
recommendation. Obviously, you're in Pine Vinyl, and you, at the moment you're doing a number of kind of in-stores and, I suppose, sort of smaller, lower-key gigs, could we call them that?
No, they're just all in-stores.
And how are you finding that? Is that sort of... We were talking just before we switched the mic on that. It's a bit...
I find it really awkward and weird, a weird thing to do. It's great that it does it. I mean, it's all about keeping record stores alive, I think, more than anything else, more than who plays in there. It's more like kind of making it a thing to go somewhere and see music in a music shop, I think, is pretty cool. Obviously, here you have pies as well. But all the music shops I'm going to, you know, they're not just Very rarely are they just music shops anymore. They have to do something else just to get by. I went to Rise Records in Bristol, and they've now got a coffee and cake and bar place downstairs. And before, it was just all records. The only place that's still just a record shop is Spillers in Cardiff. They're doing, but then they've moved as well to somewhere smaller because they couldn't maintain that large space that they had. So, but it's like making it a thing again, making people come to their local record store to see something fun and forging that relationship, especially if you're an independent music artist with independent music stores, I think is important.
There's a natural link, isn't there? I think.
Yeah, it makes sense. Everyone's kind of grafting and trying to make it work. So,
and you're playing in Marlborough, in the depths of Wiltshire. You're playing Lewis and Bex Hill coming up.
Yes.
You've also got, very excitingly, you've got you're doing something in Brussels.
Oh, yeah.
Next week.
Yeah.
And you're playing at something called the, I'm going to pronounce it wrongly, but the Europavox Festival.
Europavox, yeah.
In
right.
Clermont-Ferrand in France. My French isn't very good.
Yeah.
So you're getting an opportunity to kind of travel and sort of dip your toe in the festival circuit as well, I guess.
Most of the stuff I do is not in Britain, just for reasons of the people who are involved. My booking agent is a German man, so I go to Germany a lot, and my record label are based in Brussels, and independent record label based in Brussels. So yeah, it's kind of strange. The first album did really well in France, so that's a link with France. It's strange. It kind of appeals, I think, a lot to... It's not very cool music, you know? It's not cool music. It doesn't fit in anywhere, really. But which makes it quite hard in Britain sometimes if you don't belong to some kind of scene, I think. It's not like... I don't have a haircut, so to speak of, if you see what I mean. It struggles sometimes. I think it gets lost.
I think that's what makes it glorious.
And dismissed.
It makes it glorious in the sense that it's very passionate, it's very hard to define, but it's very true.
Embarrassing heart music. It's really stupid. But people in France and Italy and Germany are kind of into that in a way that's a lot more... They just don't really care what it...
But you could put, very easily, you could put Leonard Cohen in that bracket you just described. It's that kind of...
Well, yeah, sure, but it's not,
no.
Let's be honest.
You're doing a gig in October, 7th of October, in fact, at the AB Club in Brussels.
Yes.
Which is coming up, which is very exciting. If anyone's in Brussels around that sort of time, go and see Liz Green.
They
if people...
can't, it's sold out.
Oh, sold out already. Wow. Learn about it on YouTube.
Yeah.
If folks want to find out more about you and your music, where should they go online?
Twitter?
Okay.
I like Twitter. It's me on Twitter or Facebook for my sins. I had to join it. They made me join it. I once went to a music conference and they talked about marketing music. And they said, hands up if you're not on Facebook. And I put my hand up and nobody else did. And everyone looked at me like I was insane. Like, get a Facebook, come on.
You could write a song about that, maybe.
Maybe. There's, we'll see.
There's some food there. Well, listen, Liz, it's been great to talk to you. Really enjoyed the set here at Pine Vinyl, and I wish you the best of luck for Haul Away, your new album. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's where all the clouds go.
Find out more about Liz and her music at www.lizgreenmusic.co.uk or on her label site www.playitagainsam.net. We move now to more music by the way of the new album from the Eels, The Cautionary Tale of Mark Oliver Everett. And Simon, this is something you've thrown on our table. It's an interesting album, this one. I've been listening to it a bit. There's a bit of context I think I should throw out there, which is this is actually quite a personal album from the lead singer of the Eels. Some people would say it's not really an Eels album. They released it after their current album, which was the album before it. I've confused people already. What I mean is it was recorded, it was canned, if you like. It was put on the back shelf for kind of further development, and they worked on another album while that one was maturing.
It's very much like a midlife crisis album, it seems to me. I mean, the Eels kind of came about in the 90s, and they kind of mixed, in some ways similar to artists like Beck, they mix more folk kind of traditions with sometimes sampling or kind of like breakbeats and that kind of thing. This is much more of a, as Dave was saying, more like a Simon and Garfunkel vibe, Neil Young, those kind of things. It's a very introspective album. He's looking back on his life. He's kind of coming to certain conclusions about how the next chapters of his life are going to unfold. He seems to have quite a delicate disposition. He seems to be quite sensitive about a few things. And you could say initially that on the outset, it sounds like quite a kind of down album. And you can understand maybe why they canned it for a while. But I think if you kind of put it off for that, you're missing out maybe. Once you listen to it, there's some kind of quite nice moments on here. And personal songwriting, appealed to me. I like it when songwriters open themselves up that much.
I found it quite a stark album, you know. It's
really?
Kind of, it's quite pared down, and it's obviously,
yeah,
you know, a guy kind of pouring his heart out.
Mm.
There's a lot of it as well, I think. It's quite a difficult listen. There are two, in the deluxe edition, there are two big long CDs, basically. The kind of the first, the kind of standard album,
has about 13 tracks on it. There are a further 13 on the bonus disc. There are all kinds of things here around failed relationships and, as you said, kind of midlife crisis, and there's balancing addiction, all those kind of things. Familiar rock and roll themes, I think, really. But what grew on me about it was it's a very authentic album, I think. You know, he's come at this and he's made this because he wants to get it out of his system. You know, kind of we've heard this before, I know, from many a troubadour. But I think Mark Everett's really taken this kind of as his opportunity to kind of put his heart and soul out there, if you like, in terms of, you know, his own kind of capsule of pain to present to people, which I can imagine would put off a lot of Eels fans, because, you know, a lot of Eels back catalogue, it's not cheery, squeaky pop, but it's quite well polished, quite sort of, you know, sort of, I don't want to use the word mainstream, but it's kind of, it's on that REM mainstream, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of alternative rock, but with a small A for the alternative, maybe. I think, interesting, you say it's quite bleak, but I think some of the tracks which stand out, like Where I'm From, Where I'm Going, they're actually got a relatively kind of pleasant outlook, you know, and he's kind of come to some kind of comfortable place where he can look to his future and kind of look to it with optimism. And even the tracks that are maybe more, how can you put it, where he's looking at the more of the bleak side of life, they're packaged in a very lush way. There's lots of nice arrangements on here and very kind of easy on the ear. In some ways, it's quite an easy listening kind of album in parts. A lot of percussion and so on to kind of make it flow along nicely.
But to give our listeners a sense of the climate, if you like, of this album, you know, some of the track titles are Lockdown Hurricane, Series of Misunderstandings, Gentleman's Choice, Dead Reckoning, Mistakes of My Youth. It's all a bit kind of, you know, it's all a little bit kind of gloomy teenage diary in some aspects. But I think it comes through. I think it's, you know, I don't want to kind of pour water on it. It comes through as a kind of, as a solid album. I think, you know, it works as an album. To pick and choose tracks out of it and listen to them doesn't quite work. You know, it's not an album in a compendium sense, I suppose. But I think as a kind of, you know, as a narrative, I think it's actually quite powerful album.
I think so. And I think if there was one which should stand out more as a single, it would be The Mistakes of My Youth, which I think hits that vibe of being, yes, it's got, he's saying some things which he regrets, but he's also talking about looking through to the future, and it's got an upbeat vibe to it.
And also, coincidentally, that's the title of Dave Allen's Christmas single, Mistakes of My Youth.
Well,
isn't that right,
Dave?
Well,
I was just... I mean, I have nothing to contribute to a discussion about the Eels because I've never heard of them even, but it did strike me, actually, that if you were going to do this business about actually examining your own life and pouring your heart and soul into things, and if I was to make a song called Mistakes of My Youth, it would probably finish on about Friday morning. You know, it would take that long to get through the whole thing. Really.
That would be a super deluxe
it's
DVD.
It's a slightly flippant observation.
Well, we're going to sample now one of the tracks from the album. This is one that Simon mentioned. This is called Where I'm From. We move now to festivals. And coming up, we've got a ragtail bunch of local festivals. And we're going to kick off by talking about the Gosport Waterfront Festival 2014, which is different, I think, from the Gosport Festival that you played at recently. That was a folk festival, I think, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was, yeah. I always hear the waterfront one, even though I live in Old Portsmouth, because the noise always comes across the water. But
So Gosport Waterfront Festival is taking place on the 18th of July. This is a free event, and some of the great acts coming up include Thunderstruck, who are an AC/DC tribute band. On the 19th of July, the Corgis. I'm not really sure about them.
I think they live at Buckingham Palace, don't they, mate?
They're an acoustic electronica act from the heady days of 1979. You can also catch Pink Floyd, who are another tribute band, who I think probably are a tribute to Pink Floyd, a band we've probably heard of before. Another festival to mention is the Curious Arts Festival. You can find out more information on that at curiousartsfestival.com. They're doing an evening music lineup, including Ben Lovett from Mumford and Sons, Kevin Jones from Bear's Den, and Ian Grimble. But they've also got, I think, Ed Harcourt is going to be playing, along with Joan as policewoman. That's taking place on the Friday 18th of July, Saturday 19th of July, and Sunday the 20th of July at the Pilewell Park Cricket Ground, which is unknown to us, somewhere in Hampshire. A lot of these festivals clash and fall into each other's timescales, which isn't very helpful, but you just have to be very quick when you're running around the map. Coming up on Sunday the 20th of July at the Wickham Festival
incorporating Stokes Bay Festival, is very important, is Gino Washington on the 20th of July. I'm not sure if he's still with the Ram Jam Band, but he's there nonetheless. You've also got the likes of James Blunt, the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain, the Oyster Band, Three Daft Monkeys, Ray Cooper, Hazel O'Connor, Hugh Cornwall, the Poozies, had to say that very carefully on air, and Caravan of Thieves, an old classic, a folk classic, Bellowhead, are playing at the Wickham Festival this year. If you want to find out more about that, you can go to www.wickhamfestival.co.uk. Simon, you've been ruffling the festival book, and you found a couple of interest, I think.
Yeah, I mean, certainly going further afield, Truck Festival is quite an independent, interesting one back in Oxfordshire. That's on mid-July. And then obviously we've got the Victorious Festival in the Dockyard. That's been going from strength to strength. It's got a strong lineup this year. It's good to see some local organisers making a go of it on, you know, a large scale.
They have Shed Seven and Sophie Ellis-Bextor at the Victorious Festival.
Yeah, and Dizzy Rascal and Too Many DJs.
Mr. Rascal, I'll be there for your gig, I think, as Mr. Paxman might once have said. Also coming up locally on the 20th of September is Southsea Fest. We should mention that. Tickets are around £12. Some of these events are free, some of these are chargeable. They've got a full lineup of bands I've never heard of, some I have heard of, but to give you a flavour, Dinosaur Pileup, Fear of Men, Fickle Friends, Fred Page, Furs, Pixel Fix, Slaves, We the Wild. Have you heard of any of those, Dave?
No, I haven't.
Well, that's all the more reason to go down there and get moving.
A lot of them begin with F, I notice.
They
used to be a time when a lot of bands began with K. Kasabian and Killers, and I noticed that. I have no idea about any of these bands, but I did notice that a lot of them began with K, which I thought was interesting.
I love these popular beat combos and the names that they
absolutely
come up with.
There's
one
right
here called Passport to Stockholm.
Well,
even
why
better.
Wouldn't it be?
Even better.
Reminiscent of Jerry and the Pacemakers, almost.
We'll put a number of links to the festivals that are going on over July, August, September on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. But before we round off the series, we've got some events. So if those weren't enough for you, we've got some things that you can catch up a little bit nearer in the future. And Dave, you've got a bundle.
Well, I have got a bundle, and the first one is a bit festival related, really. If you cast your minds back, no, actually, you've got to be as old as me, but if you could cast your minds back to the first great rock festival of 1967, the Monterey Pop Festival, where Jimi Hendrix burnt his guitar and so on and so on. Among the acts featured were Janis Joplin, who gave a quite extraordinary performance, and Country Joe and the Fish, the great psychedelic band from San Francisco. And it happens that on Wednesday the 2nd of July at Eastney Cellars, there is a thing called the San Franciscan Nights, where a lady called Bex Marshall, who's an English blues singer, and very fine blues singer, she's going to be Janis Joplin, and she's going to have a backup band of four guys who, between them, have played with Country Joe and the Fish, the Steve Miller Band, and the Blues Project. So it's a real kind of recreation of those times. That's Eastney Cellars on Wednesday the 2nd of July. My other things are that I've got a gig on Saturday the 5th of July, so I figure it's worth telling you about, because I hardly ever do gigs, but I do occasionally. So my little kind of skiffly blues band, Repetit and Gone, we're doing this acoustic gig at the Milton Hall. They have quite regular gigs there. It's completely acoustic. You turn up, you don't pay to get in, you bring your own booze and or food if you feel like it, and they pass the hat round at some point, and three or four bands play and we're playing, and that will finish at about 11 o'clock, when I will whiz down to the Dock Soul Club and do some dancing to Tamla Motown, as I usually do. On the following Saturday, the 12th of July, in the City Library, there is the Portsmouth History Fair, and I'm one of the speakers at that, talking about keeping local archives. But there's a whole range of people talking about various... There's somebody talking about women workers in the dockyard. I can't remember the whole thing, but you can find it, I'm sure, on the library website. And finally, right at the end of July, since we are in Hampshire and we've already mentioned a cricket ground, I really can't leave July alone without mentioning the fact that there is a five-day test match at the Aegeus Bowl, and it will coincide with the precise start of the First World War. And there is going to be some kind of commemoration during the test match of that event, because the First World War had some significant impact on first-class cricket in the summer of 1914. So, and that's 27th to 31st of July.
Excellent. Now, Simon, you've got one to mention as well.
Yes, certainly. Joella Wheatley is having an exhibition at the Aspect starting on the 6th of June, describing the work as geometric, abstract, architectural and graphic.
That's it for this show and, in fact, the series. We'll be back with a catch-up show in August and we reopen the shop properly in September. Our thanks to Liz Green and Pie and Vinyl and to Creative Arts faculty at the University of Portsmouth. My thanks, as ever, to Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs for helping to hold the hold steady. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.